2 of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. This segment of the show is brought to us by our friends over at Randy's Electric. They sponsor our visits with our D.C. correspondent, Andrew Langer, who we will get to momentarily. But first, let's wrap up Sam's top five for a Monday.
Number five.
A 15-year-old is, not 15-year-old, 15 years in prison for a hacker-for-hire defendant who targeted government agencies in Minnesota. From the Star Tribune, a New Mexico man who is not 15 years old but is going to spend 15 years in prison has been accused of paying hackers to sabotage websites affiliated with his former employers and government agencies in Minnesota, including the state's court system. He's been sentenced to 15 years in prison. In one of the first cases of its kind in Minnesota, the sentence of John K. Gamel of Las Cruces last week in federal court in St. Paul includes 5 years supervised release and restitution that authorities were still trying to determine. Gamel's attacks on the websites of his victims had real consequences for small businesses, educational institutions, government entities, and others, for no reason other than that Gamel wanted to cause them harm. That's according to Assistant U.S. Attorney Timothy Rank. He said that in a statement. He also said Gamel used his technical knowledge and the internet's cloak of anonymity to commit his crimes, all while knowing the damage he was causing and believing he would never be caught. Gamel pleaded guilty in January to conspiracy to cause intentional damage to a protected computer and being a felon in possession of a firearm. His plea staved off what would have been one of the country's first federal trials on hacking conspiracy charges.
Boy, you talk about like the worst case scenario. You got a guy that's got this kind of knowledge and just wants to watch the world burn, like in his own way.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, again, if you take this at face value, that this was, you know, simply his wanting to wreak havoc, you know. Not that it makes it any better if it was somebody pointing him that direction or paying him to go and do it, but you got a guy who just wants to cause chaos,
yeah.
You know. And it kind of leads into what we talk about a lot when you talk about that Russia collusion. Talk about the Russian meddling. Don't want to get those confused. Talk about Russian meddling, the Facebook post they put up, the fake Twitter pages. And that is to say that don't just think that's only Russia that wants to do that. We have our own people right inside of our own borders that do the same kind of nonsense.
Oh, it happens all the time. That happens all the time. I mean, it's incredibly like frighteningly easy to cause mayhem through hacking and people. There's people out there that, you know, just average everyday people. They just know how to do it and they just do it for fun.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't really get talked about a lot, but the amount of resources that are spent by governments and businesses simply to protect, you know, their computer network is pretty staggering. 651-989-5855 is the phone number. Joining us now, brought to us by our friends from Randy's Electric, our D.C. correspondent, president of the Institute for Liberty, Andrew Langer. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. And yes, this is exactly why it astounds me that the Democrats let this guy Imran Awan, their IT head, who may have been working for Pakistani intelligence, get as far as he did. One would think they would have known better.
Well, and again, another aspect. When you talk about, you know, scandals and investigations, you know, that's a name that doesn't get brought up nearly enough. It gets pushed off to the side, you know, in the wake of the latest Trump tweet or whatever the narrative is to try to bring this president down. But as we've been, you know, talking about Andrew Langer here this morning, to kind of do a reset as we unpack the latest developments on the big news late last week, kind of starting with Trump tweeting about it, but the New York Post also writing an article about this alleged FBI informant inside the Trump campaign prior to when the sort of official investigation was taking place after the dossier. So give us Andrew Langer, give us a reset on this whole thing.
Well, I mean, listen, this whole thing changes the timeline somewhat of what we know. I find this fascinating. So the guy's name is Stefan Halper. He's a professor at Cambridge, and he's an American. He heads their American Studies program, and he is allegedly the FBI's informant or source inside the Trump campaign. It sort of came to light over the weekend that this guy had been courting both George Papadopoulos and Carter Page. What I find really interesting is that CNN refuses, they said this morning, CNN is refusing to give this guy's name because they don't, quote unquote, believe in compromising methods and sources, which means that, incidentally, that the FBI was in fact running. They are admitting, they are agreeing that the FBI was running some sort of spy, right? Methods and sources is what we use, the phrase we use to protect spies, running some sort of spy within the Trump campaign. And what we know is this guy, Halper, reached out to both Carter Page and Papadopoulos. How did he know that they were targets in this? How did he know that they were under investigation? Well, somebody within the FBI must have told him. That's a whole another question. And then that was in early July. In early July, he starts reaching out, July of 2016. In August of 2016, he amps up his bona fides with these guys by offering George Papadopoulos $3,000 to write a paper. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if somebody came to me and said, hey, you know, write a paper for me, here's $3,000, that would make me take their take their interest in me more seriously.
Well, and one thing to add to that, it was the $3,000, but this was also an offer for this you know, young and inexperienced campaign aide, the $3,000 and an all expenses paid trip to London to write to write the paper. I mean you talk about wooing, and this is a story, this is out of the New York Post. Talk about wooing this particular individual. $3,000, yeah, that's one thing, but you include sort of, yeah, you know, all expenses paid, we'll bring you over here, you know, we'll take care of you.
And Cambridge, and write him and the Cambridge bona fides, right? There's a certain credence. Oh my God, I get to go write a paper, I've been offered by this guy at Cambridge to do it. I mean, who wouldn't take that up? And so it was then, after that relationship was established, that that Halper then offers his services to the Trump campaign in late August, right? Just as the Steele dossier situation was heating up, Halper goes to get himself fully embedded in the campaign and with the campaign folks. And so this is really serious stuff. You know, we've been talking about sort of the counterintelligence investigation not really amping up until a couple weeks after the Hillary Clinton investigation was closed again. Peter Strzok at DOJ being the FBI being the linchpin here. This sort of moves up that timeline by a couple of weeks, which is important because it seems that Strzok sort of seamlessly turned from one thing to the other.
Well, and there's an interesting piece, and we'll spin this into our conversation. The Powerline blog has a post up talking about why Trump tweets, and makes a comment at the start of the piece of, when I talk to Trump haters, invariably the first thing they cite against him is his tweets. And he says, you know, in truth, sometimes they're not the best, but on the whole, Twitter has helped him. It talks about the Associated Press story and how the Associated Press story on this was picked up because Trump tweeted about it. You get towards the end of this particular piece, it talks about the tweet on Thursday with Trump citing the National Review article suggesting the FBI source was really a confidential informant in the campaign, saying, if so, this is bigger than Watergate. And this is what I wanted to zero in on. The Powerline blog goes on to say, yeah, if true, it's 1,000 times bigger than Watergate. You know, until now, wild horses couldn't have pulled the facts that have been steadily emerging about the real scandals of the 2016 election out of the AP. So why does the AP grudgingly cover them now? Because they were tweeted by President Trump.
Well, that's exactly right. This is what we've been talking about since the beginning. President Trump does not want his message to get all caught up in the filter of the major media. Now, listen, that's the role of the major media, is to sort of take and interpret and look at and analyze, just as we're doing right now. But if President Trump wants his unfiltered message to get out, he goes right over the media, directly into the eyes of the American people, by tweeting out about it. And so it is, yeah, I mean, listen, Lord knows I don't want him tweeting out about Cossefe or whatever else, whatever nonsense he may be tweeting. On the other hand, this has always been about getting people focused on what Trump wants them to focus on, good or bad. That's just the way it is.
There's an interesting, I'm trying to think of how I want to word this, but there's a lot of talk. Okay, you look at social media, you look at the articles being written, a lot of talk about how the people that are involved in this, that are closely aligned with all of this, that know what's really going on, that this is all, we're getting indications that they all realize where this whole thing is now heading based off these new revelations. There's an article here out of The Hill talking about the DOJ asking a watchdog to probe the Trump campaign surveillance. And the quote in here from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein: if anyone did infiltrate or surveil participants in a presidential campaign for inappropriate services, we need to know about it and take appropriate action. there was a lot of focus on Fox News this morning on Rod Rosenstein kind of being as upfront as he was being in, if this took place, we need to make sure that we find out about it moving forward. Again, this looks like it's teetering on the brink of erupting into that scandal with evidence that's bigger than Watergate.
Well, and how does Rod Rosenstein not know about this? Somebody to explain that to me.
Right.
To me, that whole that Rosenstein statement was a real CYA move on his. I don't know about it. No, but I mean, I'm just one of the most senior people over at the DOJ, but I had no idea throughout all of this time that the DOJ had an informant, that the FBI had an informant in the Trump campaign. What? I mean, listen, if it wasn't for the fact, again, you know, seeing as how I'm the D.C. correspondent for the, you know, Justice and Drew show, I'm not surprised it's incompetence in Washington, D.C. But I mean, this is where we are now, where a guy like Rod Rosenstein is claiming complete ignorance of something that is materially important in all this.
Well, and you, when we were, and I mentioned your comment earlier, we were chatting before the show started online, and you raised that question, and I'll let you do it. But if there was concern over Russia meddling, and I'll let you go ahead and pick it up
I don't want to give full credit for this. Andrew McCarthy at the National Review is the one who really raised it. I'm just sort of repeating this.
Sure.
Thing. He has a great piece late last week about the New York Times article. And here are the two central sort of questions here are, when did the criminal investigation of Trump activity, Trump Inc. activity turn into a counterintelligence investigation? Mm-hmm. A. And more importantly, if Russians were meddling in the election and the FBI got wind of this, how come the FBI did not immediately launch into an investigation of Russian activities? Why did they turn to Team Trump? And the answer is simple. Insurance policy.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. It is really the whole thing is really just astonishing. And you can't.
I mean, listen, guys. It gets down to exactly what you and I talked about, which is if Hillary had won, we would never know about this.
No, we would not be discussing any of this. There would be no revelations whatsoever. And it's not like the Obama administration did not have a pattern of sort of weaponizing government agencies for partisan purposes. I mean, this is just...
If you don't mind, I'm going to take that today because I completely left that out of this whole narrative. That's absolutely true. What we know of the Obama administration is that they had absolutely no qualms against doing stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. And the FBI's got a history of engaging in this type of behavior.
Of course.
I mean, you know, going all the way back to the civil rights era, and even before that.
Before.
This is not that you don't have to be a tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist to sort of understand and accept that all of these things are very real possibilities.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. I mean, you know, this is since day one. One had thought we had moved away from this with the FBI, but then again, as you said, with the Obama administration, nothing should surprise us anymore.
Now, this is really interesting. It's just to step aside for just a moment. New Hampshire Register. Hillary Clinton was at Yale speaking to. This was like speech day or class day at Yale. Okay, talking to Yale seniors. This is what she had to say. This is astounding. Okay. She says this: right now we're living through a full-fledged crisis in our democracy.
That's true.
No, there are not tanks in the streets, but what's happening right now goes to the heart of who we are as a nation. And I say this not as a Democrat who lost an election, but as an American afraid of losing a country. There are certain things that are so essential, they should transcend politics. Waging war on the rule of law, the free press, delegitimizing elections, perpetuating shameless corruption, rejecting the idea that our leaders should be public servants undermines our national unity, and attacking truth and reason, evidence and facts should alarm us all. Wow. And so that's like the most honest she ever could have been, because she's talking about herself, right?
Yes.
Project much?
Gets down to what I've long said. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you project much? I mean, yeah, that's all true, Hillary. Look in the mirror.
Again, listen, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever want to know what your enemy is doing, listen to what they're accusing others of. I mean, it's exactly what it comes down to.
You know, and the one thing, we've joked about this so many times, but it needs to be said, this whole Russia collusion narrative, right? you take in total this information we have now, the dossier, all of it, right? And you mean to tell me that with all of this that apparently was swirling around the Trump campaign, and with all of these individuals and all this firsthand knowledge of all this stuff, that there still is one guy out there with the memory stick that has the evidence of Russia collusion that they still have decided not to bring forward yet? I mean, in the wake of all of this, you know, there still hasn't been a shred of tangible evidence of any collusion, even in the midst of all of this stuff and looking into the Trump campaign.
Maybe Michael Avenatti holds the key.
Yeah, it's Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, Michael Avenatti holds the key to this whole thing. He's got that little bit of information that Mueller has failed to uncover.
Well, this is why they're now turning to this supposed Trump, you know, Trump Jr. meeting with UAE folks in Trump Tower in August, and anonymously spreading it as some sort of campaign collusion thing. I mean, this is where we are. But the reality is, listen, there's something super serious going on here, and very disturbing in the end. The president's right. It's 1,000 times bigger than Watergate, if true. Well, you know, listen, let's remember what Watergate was about, right? It was about a president looking like he was going to win, but, you know, nevertheless, using former members of the intelligence community to spy on the political opposition. I mean, I don't know if it's 1,000 times worse than Watergate, but it's certainly... it eerily mirrors Watergate in the same way that Barack Obama was one of the most Nixonian presidents we've had in memory.
Well, what disturbs me about this whole thing, right, and let's take these accusations at face value, say they need to be investigated. What disturbs me is there will continue to be an absolute unwillingness to accept any of this as true by so many people for simply partisan reasons. I mean, right. We can uncover all of the evidence that verifies it, and you're still going to have a large segment of the population out there that's simply going to shrug their shoulders and dismiss it and choose to not believe it because Trump.
Well, yeah, it's going to come down to whether or not once Mueller goes away, it's going to come down to what happens in the midterm elections in November, in the end. Because if things do get ramped up for if the Democrats take both houses of Congress and we find ourselves in the midst of an impeachment process, then everything gets ramped up again. If the Republicans retain both houses, which I think is entirely possible, especially now, then maybe it's time that things sort of, the nation could take a deep breath and move forward. I mean, you will always have the never Trumpers. You will always have the Democrats who are not going to go down. But maybe, just maybe, as the economy continues to improve and get steady and grow and get stronger, maybe things can calm down a bit.
Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty, as always, man. Great talking with you. Thanks for the commentary and insight, man. We really appreciate it.
Talk to you later on.
We'll catch up with you next week. And thank you to Randy's Electric for sponsoring our visits with Andrew Langer every single Monday.
A couple of quick comments from this from the Hillary Clinton Yale speech. She also said this, Drew. Let me get this out of the way. Clinton said, no, I'm not over it. I still think about the 2016 election.
Really?
I would never have guessed.
I still regret the mistakes I made. I still think, though, that understanding what happened in such a weird and wild election in American history will help us defend our democracy in the future, whether you're right, left, center, Republican, Democrat, independent, vegetarian, whatever. We all have a stake in that. So today, as a person, I'm okay. But as an American, I'm concerned.
Mm. Well, you go on and be concerned.
Yeah, you be concerned, lady.
Just go be concerned and stay out of politics. Just be concerned.
Oh. Just disgusting. Well, from one disgusting thing to another, we will get to all the vetoing.
Yeah,
and the more veto threats from the jerk that we have for a governor, Mark Dayton.
I don't really understand what's going on here.
+1 989 5855 is the phone number, or use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter to communicate with the show throughout the morning. We're going to be moving into all of the craziness that happened with the legislature from over the weekend and all the pettiness of our lame duck governor.
It's just lame.
Yeah.
Just lame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just
yeah,
lame.
I don't want to insult ducks.
No, ducks don't deserve it. I saw some over the weekend. They seem just fine.
They're
very cute on their own.
Yeah.
They're not lame at all.
I'm a fan of ducks. They have better common sense. They're not as hypocritical.
Yeah, quack, quack.
Yeah, I don't see ducks just walking around, quack, quack, just being jerks to other ducks around them.
Okay, I got to take issue with that because I got some ducks on the farm and some of them
I haven't seen that happen. I haven't seen them kicking them out of ponds or nothing.
My ducks will beat up my chickens sometimes. It's a very, very messy situation.
Are we done with the ducks?
No, because we're talking about Dayton all day.
Not being a duck, just lame.
Dom in Maple Grove, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. You know, just finished reading Comey's book on higher loyalty.
Why?
I wasn't going to, but I just wanted to get the guy's perspective on the whole issue. The guy has a way with words, you know. The guy, he really tries to paint himself as a work in process Picasso of the intelligence community. You know, like, I'm about the fray, everybody else has got an issue. You know, he kind of throws, at some point in the book, Hillary, Loretta Lynch, even Obama, and to some extent Rob Rosenstein under the bus. Sounds to me like he's trying to buy a bulletproof armor from being prosecuted through the public sympathy. And, you know, he's going on about, you know, how I was right, everybody else was wrong. And he seems to conclude with, I am Gandhi, and the rest of you are morons. And that's the way he concludes that thing. But, you know, he did say, he justifies the public announcement of Hillary's email investigation by saying that he made enemies on both sides of the aisle, so he's above the fray.
Apparently, that's not how it works.
That's his conclusion. apparently, someone at the Bureau raised the possibility that Trump might win if he broadcast the Hillary email investigation, but his reply to that seems to be, well, we can't talk about that because the FBI is nonpartisan. You know, interesting take on that thing. That's how I share that.
Well,
thanks, Dom. I appreciate it.
Book reviews from Dom. No, look, Comey, he was convinced like everybody else that she was going to win. He was trying to clear himself.
He was. Well, yeah, he said he was trying to clear the air so that when she won,
right,
it wouldn't be viewed as an illegitimate president. And look where we are now. Everything that's happened since the election has been done with the intent to make Trump appear as an illegitimate president.
I'm going to be cynical. Look, the best that I can hope for with all of this, right, is that the Mueller investigation comes to an end without having found any evidence, because there probably isn't any, of Trump-Russia collusion, and we can all just move on with our lives. I don't think these individuals are going to be held accountable. You know, if it was done for political purposes, this informant inside the Trump campaign prior to the dossier, then yeah, I hope people are held accountable. I don't think it's going to happen.
No.
We don't ever see that happen. There's too many individuals entrenched within D.C. that'll shield people who are ultimately responsible for what happened taking place. You know, the best, in my opinion, the best that I personally can hope for, I won't speak for you, is that, again, the Trump-Russia collusion investigation is over. There's no evidence of that because, again, most likely didn't happen. And I pray that moving forward, when it comes to politics, people will be more aware of the level of corruption that actually takes place in Washington based off of the evidence that we've seen happen around the Trump campaign.
I know we need to shift gears to the legislature stuff, but I just want to point out a couple of tweets that have popped up on my radar in the last hour or so. Ari Fleischer tweeted earlier, there was a text from an FBI agent talking about Peter Strzok. And from an FBI agent in 2016 that says, quote, the White House is running this. Referring to the opening of the Trump investigation in 2016, August of 2016. And today's press corps pays it no attention. They're just ignoring that whole angle of these text messages and this everything we learned from Strzok and Page and all the text messages that were released from them. It's amazing. The press looks under the way. They wonder why people think they are biased. That the White House is running this.
They were talking about a potluck.
Right.
They're having a big potluck.
And I share your pessimism when it comes to accountability, but the fact of the matter is, if we're going to look at this as a potential, with the worst case scenario, right, if we're going to take these things that we know at face value and really assume that, you know, what the president has been tweeting about and what he's been saying, there's truth and there's facts and there's evidence behind it, people need to go to jail.
Yes. Oh, I agree.
And it's frustrating that, you know, that you and I can both sit here with no degree of confidence whatsoever that that will actually happen, because it's all so political. Andrew Linger was right. We are going to get through the midterms, and how the midterms play out is going to determine whether or not this whole conversation and narrative sort of fades away.
Yeah.
Goes away, or if it continues to be ramped up.
The president has actually, and Drew, you may want to bring up the most recent ones. The president was retweeting, I believe, Dan Bongino,
yeah,
who we've had an opportunity to talk to on a few different occasions.
Trump tweets.
Trump tweets.
Trump tweets.
Yeah, yeah.
Trump tweets.
Trump tweets.
He always tweets.
What now?
Oh, shit.
It's actually a series of three tweets from the president starting 31 minutes ago, and he's quoting, not retweeting, but quoting Dan Bongino. It's kind of long. It's a three-tweet thread. Starts off by saying, John Brennan is panicking. He has disgraced himself. He has disgraced the country. He has disgraced the entire intelligence community. He is the one man who is largely responsible for the destruction in America's faith in the intelligence community and in some people at the top of the FBI. Brennan started this entire debacle about President Trump. We now know that Brennan had detailed knowledge of the phony dossier. He knows about the dossier. He denies knowledge of the dossier. He briefs the Gang of Eight on the Hill about the dossier, which they then use to start an investigation about Trump. It is that simple. This guy is the genesis of this whole debacle. It was a political hit job, not an intelligence investigation. Brennan has disgraced himself. He's worried about staying out of jail. End quote.
Yeah, there was a lot of, and I'm glad that we covered that, because there's been a lot of talk about, if you go and look at Brennan's comments, there's a lot of people that are pointing to his lashing out over this, of basically kind of doing the Rod Rosenstein dance of, we need to get on top of this, you know, is the CYA move of him trying to establish his own narrative about what is actually taking place. And again, going back to our conversation with Andrew Langer, this idea that it's coming quickly to a head. And this latest angle of this latest controversy is another example of that. Before we get to, we're going to get to your phone call, 651-989-5855. We do want your comments as we move over into the end of the legislative session. Lots of different stories to cover. Veto threats by Governor Mark Dayton hangs over legislative session's final bills. We'll give you all the latest. In the few minutes, though, real quick, before we have to take a break, Drew, quick Kilauea update, right? That volcano is still going off. Did you see what happened to one dude? The first known injury? This is bad. So Hawaii continues to brace for eruptions from Kilauea. A man was seriously injured. He was sitting. He was on his third floor balcony. He's kicking it on his third floor balcony.
Uh-oh. You probably feel pretty safe up there from lava.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a lava splatter.
Oh, no.
That sounds terrifying.
First known injury related to Hawaii's Kilauea volcano eruptions. The homeowner, okay, was hit with lava on the shin, taken to a hospital with serious injuries. Fast-moving lava flows are threatening to cut off a major escape route for individuals in the region, as they're worried about, again, the gases coming off of this. This guy, though, on his third-floor balcony, it hit him on the shin, shattered everything from there down his leg.
No.
They added the lava splatter could weigh as much as a refrigerator.
Huh.
And even small pieces of spatter can kill you. Even small pieces can actually kill you from go away.
Mm.
Leave the area.
Yeah.
It's a volcano.
Yeah.
It's a volcano.
Don't chill on your deck.
Yeah, come to Minnesota.
Yeah.
It's really nice up here this time of year.
Yeah, even in winters.
We have so little lava.
Yeah.
We've just got so little lava to deal with.
None of the lava.
Remarkably small amounts
of lava. The least amount of lava
that
you could possibly imagine.
Or just buy yourself a lava lamp. You just do.
Yeah, if you need your lava
you need your lava. Yeah, your lava fill. Get yourself a lava lamp.
Justice.
It's apropos. Dayton dropped a bomb on the all the efforts of the legislature, man. Multiple bombs. Nothing for you. Veto for you. Nothing for you. I'm just going to obstruct everything because I'm a big jerk.
We will have We expect to have Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka on the show tomorrow. We'll get a full debrief from him on the final weekend, the crazy weekend of the legislative session. I imagine most of the legislators are sleeping right now.
Right?
They did adjourn last night.
Minnesota lawmakers, late Sunday, did just that, finalized a handful of tax and spending measures, but with little chance they'd have much to show for 3 months of work, as Governor Mark Dayton vowed to veto most of their major efforts, according to the Star Tribune story.
Caught up in the tense political fight between the DFL governor and Republican legislative leaders were changes to the state's tax code, including an income tax cut and tax conformity, the most important part, new protections for nursing home residents, money for school districts facing budget shortfalls, money to combat the opioid epidemic, and a public works bonding bill to help pay for statewide infrastructure upgrades. Dayton has pretty much said he's going to veto all of these things. We'll see. It remains to be seen, because he's, you know, you can't always take him at his word, and a lot of times he'll, you know, he'll begrudgingly sign things into law and then complain about them later. But it really feels like with this, you know, being a lame duck, you know, not running for reelection, with that he's just honey badgering this whole thing.
Well, and I'm a little surprised, and I'm just going to check it out right now, real quick, while we talk here, because there's been plenty of time for the Star Tribune specifically to come to Dayton's defense on all of this, and I do find the lack of the spontaneous support editorials from the Star Tribune. I don't know whether that is telling or not telling. I am legitimately surprised. I would have expected some level of press support for the governor at this point in time if they were completely on board with what he did over this weekend. You know, I'd like to believe that even some of those within, you know, the left wing media, if you will, and the DFL are also upset with this. His arguments just don't fly. He says it's all about themselves, their own reelection, and it's disgusting. Look, you can keep hammering that point all you want, but so is what you're doing. So is what you're doing. You're refusing to let the GOP have a win on anything, even if it means that the people who desperately need the help the most on some of these different bills aren't going to get it. It doesn't matter to him. He refuses to let them have a single win. And I can't help but think, and I know, Drew, you pointed to, you know, many times about, like, with the emergency funding for the schools, the $138 million, you know, a gift to the teachers union, to the unions, right? Part of me thinks that this is trying to be a gift to the DFL. He wants them to be able to you know, have Walls come in and be the guys that are going to fix all this mess that he's going to walk away from and veto without giving the GOP any possibility to score any kind of victory in his mind.
Maybe. I don't know. It's so hard to determine with this governor, because, you know, he throws around the word emergency. He says these draconian budget shortfalls are going to result in massive layoffs and things like that. And there are a handful of school districts that, despite the $2 billion in new money that has gone to schools over the last biennium, there are still a handful of school districts, through their own fault, are still experiencing budget shortfalls. This can be addressed. If it is truly an emergency, this can be and should be addressed in a special session, but Dayton has adamantly and steadfastly refused to even consider a special session. He needed that money. He needed it now. He didn't want any questions asked. Now, the tax bill did get vetoed, not because of anything that was in the tax bill, but because of what wasn't in the tax bill. And there's a constitutional question as to whether that veto is even allowed, you know, because you have to give reasons for a veto. And Kurt Dowd raised the question yesterday of whether or not it is actually constitutional to veto a bill because of things that aren't in it. That being said, I don't expect that to really go anywhere. But Republicans did repass the tax bill, and they did get some DFL votes. So there's some bipartisan cred to this, and it did include some new money for schools, and it redirected money from other funds. Representative Jennifer Loon said she's the school finance chief in the House. She begged Dayton in a floor speech to reconsider. She said, "I say this sincerely, Governor, and I hope you're listening." He probably wasn't. "We have listened. We want this to work. We want this to be possible for our schools. Let's all swallow our pride over what we had to have, thumped our chests over, and recognize that we've come a long way towards meeting in the middle." If Governor Dayton vetoes the tax bill, and this is the, to me, this is the most important bill that's sitting on his desk right now. All the other ones, there's some good ones. There's some good stuff in there. There's some bad stuff in there. I don't particularly care though. For me, it's all about the tax bill, because if this doesn't pass and we do not get this tax conformity, every taxpayer in Minnesota is going to feel pain. Every business and every individual.
You had Senate Minority Leader Tom Bach reiterated the criticism from Dayton that the GOP crafted a plan that was too favorable to big business. This bill is a huge giveaway to huge corporations that are making huge profits in this state and don't want to be taxed on them. That's shameful. Shameful. No, what's shameful is you guys continue to use that lame excuse.
Right.
Among their last votes, they did approve a major infrastructure spending package. As Showers borrowed money on public works projects. On Sunday, Republicans agreed to on a compromise package of projects, $79 million for the University of Minnesota, $129 million for Minnesota State, more than $500 million for the Department of Transportation, among dozens of other small projects, small and large, from school safety grants, veteran homes, to a 50-meter pool for the city of New Hope. It includes $25 million for school safety measures in response to the recent shootings. DFL Representative Alice Hossman has said, in favor of the bonding bill, you are voting for a huge amount of infrastructure all over the state. Many weren't satisfied, though, and we talked about this last week. It's inadequate for the needs of the state. It's just not enough. The bill's total spending was $1.57 billion. $400 million of the transportation spending would be delayed until 2022 to 24. Minnesota's Management and Budget Commissioner Myron Franz, who was deeply involved with the negotiations with the legislative leaders as Dayton's budget chief, called the bonding measure disappointment, missed opportunity, critiquing the amount of spending and the choice of projects. Still, Dayton refrained from threatening to veto it. And you know what? I'm going to throw a little negativity on some of the press that had the opportunity to interview Dayton over the weekend, because They did such a bad job of pressing him, especially on the emergency funding, because they asked him, they did ask specifically about why did you bring it up at the end of session, and Dayton just dodged it, you know, said, well, they knew about what was going on beforehand. They should have been aware. We had the money in the surplus, but they failed to follow up with the legitimate next question. And that legitimate next question was, not every single district in the state is facing those types of cuts. It was a very specific number of districts that needed to have emergency funding if you fall along those lines. Why not just target specifically those particular districts? They didn't even bother to ask him that question.
Over 553 school districts in the state of Minnesota, and around 59 are experiencing budget shortfalls. And he wanted to give money to every single school district.
Yeah. And because I want to.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's got no better excuse than that.
It was just a parting gift from the Dayton administration before he rides off into the sunset and goes to Bolivia.
You know, and then we brought this up earlier, and this is the one that's so painful, vetoing on Saturday the $9 million in funds intended for the vehicle license center operations, who say they've lost at least twice that amount from the beleaguered new state computer system that processes vehicle titles and license plates. Even though it had overwhelming bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate, Dayton criticized the bill for not including funding to help fix the computer system known as Minlars and criticized the source of the $9 million. There's a subsequent story, because this one was out of, these are both out of the Pioneer Press. The Pioneer Press, there's another story that's attached to this. The license center operators pleading for the override of Dayton's veto, we beg of you. Unfortunately, the GOP tried to come together and override it. They were unable to, because some DFLers actually hopped on board with Dayton's ridiculous excuse for vetoing it.
Yeah, and the rumor was that that the Dayton administration was kind of strong-arming some DFL members of the legislature to push back on this veto override.
And look, he is such a jerk.
It's really petty.
It is.
There was no reason not to sign this bill for the DMV payments to help these license centers. There was no good reason.
The deputy registrars essentially end up continuing to shoulder the burden by that which was not their fault. Right? I mean, this would have been relief for them, and because he didn't get more money to fix the system that was built under his watch, these individuals that need it most have to shoulder that burden.
Right. We don't need to spend new money on this. First of all, we have a budget surplus. Dayton can find the money, and it should come out of the executive branch budget to be fair and honest. However, that being said, this bill had overwhelming bipartisan support in both the House and Senate, and Dayton vetoed it. He criticized it for not including funding to help fix the computer system, and he criticized the source of the $9 million. Deputy registrars who run the license centers and have complained for months that they've been hammered financially by Mindlars never cared where the money came from, but they definitely cared that with only a day left in the legislative session, they're not going to get any money now.
Yeah, Julie Hansen serves as deputy registrar for Scott County. Says, we beg of you, please support this. You know, and this is a broad comparison here, okay? But I'm going to make it because I'm this annoyed. Give me a rhetoric, talking, obtuse-tweeting Trump.
Right.
Okay? Give me the guy that doesn't do well speaking in public, right? Because look, at least with a guy like Trump, when you talk about the things that he says, right, that's usually up to interpretation, okay? You know, Trump said some stupid things in public, but it really comes down to how do you interpret that? What do you think those things mean to you? And that they're open to sort of, your own personal opinions in this regard. You look at what Dayton is doing. This is all too real and reckless, and it actually has tangible impact, right? So give me the guy who you don't like the way he talks and the things he says over the guy who actually has the veto power and can take away all of the legitimate efforts of the legislature in one weekend because he's just being petty and vindictive on his way out of office.
I January 2019 can't come fast enough. I mean, it feels like Governor Dayton is just intent. Like I said, he's honey badgering this whole thing, and it feels like he's intent on causing as much pain and mayhem as possible in order to sort of further the narrative going into the elections in November that all the fault is on the Republican-led legislature.
Right.
The Republican-led legislature, they did their job. They got their bills passed. Maybe it was messy. Maybe it was ugly. And if you're a conservative, there's plenty in there that's not to like. But the fact of the matter is, they did their job. They got the bills to the governor's desk. And the governor is just vetoing them all. And then he's going to go out and he's going to blame them.
Right.
He's
right.
Blame them for his veto pen.
And look, some of what Dayton said, I don't disagree with to a certain extent. Right. You have political parties at war with one another. If you have the power in the legislature and you have the ability to put your party in a better position based off the bills that you craft, right? Any party is going to do that. That's going to happen. But you can't deny the fact that the GOP has made concessions. I mean, by the end of last week, we didn't even have a bonding bill anymore. And they came forward with this $825 million bonding bill as the clock began to wind down. For Dayton to come out and say that this is all about their reelection efforts, how big of a hypocrite are you? You know, what do you think it is that you're doing? What do you think you convinced those to vote against the Mindlars funding? What do you think that they're doing? You know, stop acting like, oh, you're so above it all to not play politics with your veto.
Trust me, there aren't a lot of Republican voters out there that are excited about an $825 million bonding bill.
No!
That are eager to get out to the polls to support their representative who voted in favor of this $825 million bonding bill. Trust me, there aren't a lot of conservatives out there that are real excited by that. So to try to spin this as helping them with their reelection efforts, no, not at all.
Right.
You're not going to find a ton of conservatives out there that are going to be really upset if this doesn't end up passing into law.
Well, and to what you were saying a moment ago, the proof of sort of Dayton's rationale is in the way that he has argued for what he did. Because, as you mentioned earlier, you know, there's only a few things left that we kind of would have been on board with. The tax conformity, obviously, because that's going to affect all of us. And the Mindlars funding for the deputy registrars, right? Those are things that we kind of sit back and go, let's get those done. The other things that Dayton vetoed, had he come out and said it was for this reason and this reason, like real legitimate reasons of things like fiscal responsibility and accountability when it comes to bonding, then I would have been able to sit back and go, okay, right? You're a DFL governor, but at least I can agree with your rationale because some of these things I didn't like either. But of course, he didn't even bother. It was all just point the finger and blame the GOP for trying to be too political to sort of do a one-up on him.
Yep. And everything's about just giving him more money. You know, the tax bill won't we can't have a tax conformity because he needs more money. He wants more money. We can't reimburse these deputy registrars because he wants more money. Everything is just about making sure they keep funneling more and more money. No questions asked. And until you do that, he's just going to veto everything. It's really gross. It's really disgusting. There are, 14 days now where he's going to reconsider. And so we won't really know the fate of a lot of these bills, you know, for the next couple of weeks. But I don't know. It's not looking good. I'm not feeling too optimistic right now.
651-989-5855. Use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. Coming up, a few more items in regards to the legislative session. State lawmakers have gutted the distracted driving bills, increased the fines for texting and driving. We'll give you a few points on that. We'll visit the story that took place, the horrible shooting in Texas that took place after the show ended on Friday. And then we have Representative Jason Lewis joining us later on in the 8 o'clock hour.
8:35 this morning. He'll join us, talk about the town halls that he held over the weekend. Justice.